Iran tells the visiting EU coordinator for the Vienna talks that an agreement on the revival of the JCPOA can be reached if the U.S. acts pragmatically. Day 32 of Russia-Ukraine conflict, Kiev announces an agreement for the evacuation of civilians from frontline areas, including Mariupol. And in a rare public message of support, Israel sympathizes with Saudi Arabia over the latest wave of Yemeni retaliatory strikes. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Iran says an agreement on the revival of the JCPOA will be within reach if the U.S. acts pragmatically. Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagherikeni made the announcement this morning in a meeting with Enrique Mora, visiting EU coordinator for the Vienna talks. The meeting is part of consultations aiming to catch up remaining differences in the months-long talks between Tehran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal. The head of Iran's Strategic Council on Foreign Relations has called for the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps to be removed from the list of terrorist groups.
IRGC is a national army, and a national army cannot be listed as terrorist group. And certainly it is not acceptable. That is very important for Iranians.
Now, Kamal Kharrazi made a call at the Doha Forum. Also present at the session was U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, who said Washington has not yet decided to delist the IRGC as a terrorist entity. He said many of the sanctions on IRGC will remain in place. Now, with regard to the Vienna negotiations on the Iran deal, Malley said an agreement was close but not imminent after 11 months of discussions. Iran is demanding economic guarantees and the removal of all the U.S. sanctions in exchange for return to its commitments under the deal. Now let's take a look at the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. The two countries have agreed to open two humanitarian corridors to evacuate civilians from frontline areas. A senior Ukrainian official says that under the agreement, people will be allowed to leave the southern city of Mariupol in private cars. Meantime, Russia is pressing ahead with its military operation, which it says is aimed at degrading Ukraine's military potential and decapacitating neo-Nazi groups. Russia says it has hit military targets in the western city of Lviv with high-precision cruise missiles. This is the most significant attack on the city in the month-long war. Meanwhile, Ukraine says it has repelled seven attacks in the eastern regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. President Zelensky of Ukraine is urging Western states to provide his country with weapons and military hardware so it could defend itself against Russian attacks.
What is the price of this security? This is very, very specific. It is planes for Ukraine. It is tanks for our state. It is missile defense. It is anti-ship weapons. That is what our partners have. That is what is just gathering dust there. After all, this is all not only for the freedom of Ukraine, but for the freedom of Europe.
Speaking of video address on Saturday, Zelensky said that Ukraine is asking for just a tiny fraction of NATO's arms, not more. He also asked Europeans if they are afraid of Moscow and warned again that Russia's military operation could endanger the whole Europe. Zelensky insists that Russia will seek to expand further into Europe if Ukraine falls. But NATO does not back his request for a no-fly zone on the grounds that it could provoke a wider war. Early in the day, Zelensky talked to his Polish counterpart and demanded a rapid transfer of Russia-made fighter aircraft from Eastern Europe to Ukraine. Time now for the news review. The U.S. president has raised eyebrows after suggesting that his Russian counterpart should not remain in office.
We will have a different future, a brighter future, rooted in democracy and principle, hope and light, of decency and dignity, of freedom and possibilities. For God's sake, this man cannot remain in power. God
bless you all. Now, in response, Kremlin spokesman Dmytro Peskov said that a Russian president is elected by the people of Russia, and that's not up to Biden to decide who should be in power in that country. The White House later explained that Biden was not calling for a regime change in Russia. It said that the U.S. president meant to say that Putin cannot be allowed to exercise power over its neighbors or the region. Okay, that was the story. Now, let me invite two guests to ask for their insight and interpretation of this. So Alfred Desailles, former UN Special Rapporteur, is joining me from Geneva. Also, we'll have George Samueli, Senior Research Fellow with Global Policy Institute from Budapest. Now, Alfred, why should a world leader call names, you know, another world leader? I mean, this is not the first time, also, if you remember last year, we had President Biden calling President Putin like as a dictator or a brute or things like that. I can't remember exactly, but this is not the first time. What could be the reason? Is this a proper thing to do?
As you know, I'm an American citizen, and I'm kind of used to this kind of rhetoric. Same rhetoric of invoking God and everything that not only George Biden, but Donald Trump and Obama and George W. Bush used to do. It's imperial arrogance. Of course, it's contrary to international law. Of course, it is an interference in the internal affairs of states. It violates countless General Assembly resolutions, 2131 and 2625 and 3314, and so on and so forth. But as I said, we have precedents of permissibility. All our presidents do exactly the same thing. It is inappropriate, but they get away with it. So they call for regime change, and they do not accept Bashar al-Assad as president of Syria. They don't accept Daniel Ortega as president of Nicaragua, or Nicolas Maduro as president of Venezuela. It is almost, shall we say, comical. It is amusing that a president thinks that he can say things like that. Obviously, he doesn't say that Mohammed bin Salman can remain as in power in Saudi Arabia after the genocide being conducted against the hapless people of Yemen. He doesn't call for regime change in Saudi Arabia after the murder and the quartering of the journalist Khashoggi, who used to write for the Washington Post. Again, the double standards are by now so second nature. Right. To the United States modus operandi. As I said, it is in a way laughable if it was not so tragic, because again, people are dying. If you want to have peace in Ukraine, you can have it. One word: neutrality. Ukraine declares itself unilaterally neutral. NATO does not expand further east. And game over.
Okay. Now let me turn to Budapest and ask George Zamorelli what he thinks about this.
Well, I do think that it escalates the situation dangerously, because it comes a day after when he was speaking to soldiers, U.S. soldiers. Biden said that you will be in Ukraine and you'll see it for yourself. So therefore, it sounded like he intended to send U.S. forces into Ukraine. The White House had to rush in and correct it. And the fact that the White House had to rush in and correct this means that Biden's advisors realized that what he was doing was escalating the situation dangerously. I think that what Biden said in his speech was actually even more chilling than his call for regime change in Moscow, because he was essentially envisaging a long, protracted, years-long, decades-long war in Ukraine. I think that's the U.S. policy, which is to keep this war going in the hope that this will just weaken and demoralize and destroy Russia. The fact that in the process Ukraine will be destroyed, much of Europe will be completely overwhelmed by refugees, overwhelmed by economic crises. Right. But that's how the United States envisages. Somehow it has this notion that if we destroy everything, that's good for the United States. So that's why I think it was a very chilling speech yesterday by Biden.
Okay, appreciate your comments and insight. Alfred Desaias in Geneva, George Samueli in Budapest. Now moving on, in a rare public message of support, Israel has extended its sympathies to Saudi Arabia following a barrage of Yemeni attacks on multiple targets across the kingdom. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett expressed Israel's sorrow to Riyadh over the attack, which he described as horrific. He was referring to a wave of missile and drone strikes that the Yemeni army conducted on several sites deep inside Saudi soil on the 7th anniversary of the war 2 days ago. The strike caused a huge fire at an Aramco oil storage facility in Jeddah. The Tel Aviv regime has no formal relations with Saudi Arabia, but the UAE and Bahrain, both allies of Saudi's, normalized ties with Israel 2 years ago. In January, Tel Aviv offered security and intelligence support to the UAE after a deadly Yemeni strike hit its capital, Abu Dhabi. Yemen has announced a unilateral ceasefire, suspending all rocket and drone attacks against Saudi Arabia. It's reaffirmed its readiness to turn the declaration into a permanent commitment.
We announced the cessation of offensive confrontations on all field fronts for a period of 3 days, and we affirm our readiness to turn this suspension into a final, continuous, and permanent commitment in the event that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia announces the withdrawal of all foreign forces of the coalition from our Yemeni lands and waters and a complete stop of its support to local militias in our country.
The Mashat says Saudi Arabia must end its blockade of the Republic of Yemen once and for all. It says Yemen is also ready to perform a full prisoner exchange. He urged the UN Special Envoy for Yemen to take steps to prepare the agreements to carry out the exchanges. In the meantime, the head of Yemen's negotiating team says that Riyadh must prove its seriousness in response to the Yemeni peace plan by responding to the ceasefire, lifting the siege, and pulling out troops. The developments follow the Yemeni army's targeting multiple locations inside Saudi Arabia, including an Aramco oil facility in Jeddah and vital sites in the capital, Riyadh. Now, France's presidential election has been unlike any other in recent memory, with apathy and disinterest dominating headlines. It's the first major vote in the West since the end of the COVID, and that may explain why France appears unusually politically disoriented. Rami Mazahari reports.
France goes to the polls in just 2 weeks in an election marked by major disinterest and discontent over a lack of discussion on worsening domestic issues. Abstention is expected to reach 30%. The last time so few voters turned out was 2002, when the far-right National Front shockingly made it to the second round. Many wonder if this election, the surging left may stage a similar surprise, with Jean-Luc Mélenchon now approaching the far-right's Marine Le Pen in the battle to make it past the first round. The so-called bourgeois bloc of voters is highly motivated to win re-election for Emmanuel Macron, so he seems certain to make it to the final round. He has avoided debates and public appearances, preferring to focus on Ukraine, as his tenure has been marked by a record number of corruption scandals, economic inequality, and unprecedented political repression.
We are here to protest against the abusive government and this kingship presidency of Emmanuel Macron. The Yellow Vests are here to promote a true vision of democracy and to redistribute our nation's wealth. Every election there is more and more abstention because people don't believe in mainstream politics anymore.
In 2017, the two mainstream political parties, dogged by corruption scandals, were ousted for the first time since Charles de Gaulle. In 2012, optimism was sky high that François Hollande was going to end austerity and stand up to Berlin and Brussels. But in this election, France, a rare Western country known for high levels of political engagement, appears to be exhausted by politics. A vast and intimidating police presence at demonstrations won't encourage political gatherings either.
Everyone here can feel the intimidation towards the yellow vests. Look at how cops are surrounding us before we even start. We're the only protesters who get treated like this, except for neo-Nazi rallies. But we aren't neo-Nazis or a political party. We're simply the people.
Unions have just pulled out their big gun, an unlimited strike for Paris public transport. That strike has confusingly been stopped after just one day, perhaps showing that France remains in a state of confusion even so close to the election. France has only just ended its coronavirus restrictions, and the lack of political interest appears to show that the country hasn't really gotten back to normal. Western polls have been notoriously inaccurate, however, and sky-high inflation may play a crucial part when voters decide about the next 5 years. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
Well, that's a wrap for now.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz.
Welcome back, everyone. In the first part of the documentary, we met Heather, Josh, and Rachel. All three suffer from disability and chronic illnesses. All three are children to fathers who fought in Vietnam, and all three are victims of Agent Orange. And now they decide to embark on a journey to return to the country where their tragic story began as children of war veterans and as victims of war. Now stay with us to witness the rest of this emotional and healing journey.
My father lost his arm before he chose to have children. He lost his arm during the war. And then it took him 7 years to cope with that and feel that maybe he was mentally able to help raise a child.
The things that he had seen, he would always have flashbacks, and he suffered from PTSD really bad from all the things that he did and saw while he was in the war. And he was very abusive and he was very violent, and he would black out at times and think that he was still in the war. And there was times like we would get up in the middle of the night, me and my brother, and we would try to get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, and he would be like hiding under our beds and grab our feet and pull us under the beds. And I mean, he had PTSD really bad.
He suffered flashbacks, lots of flashbacks. Many nights he'd wake up moaning and groaning, screaming and yelling in his sleep.
They would put him in the helicopters and stuff, and they would fly him all over and drop him off in the jungle, and they would get out of the helicopters, and the helicopters would leave him out there, and there would only be like maybe 30 guys. They were hiding everywhere, and you couldn't really run through the jungle because everything was booby-trapped, and there was pits with the spikes in them and landmines everywhere and trip wires, and they had these big logs that had a bunch of bamboo spikes on them, and they'd put them up in the trees. So when you'd walk by and you'd trip a stick or whatever, it would fall down out of the tree and impale people. And there was, he said there was times that while they were on the battlefield that he would have to go and, like, his friend would be walking right in front of him and he would step on a landmine and pieces of his friend would fly all over him and he would have to pick up the pieces and put them in his backpack and carry them out.
He spent a lot of time by himself, very quiet. We were raised with war decor in our home, lots of Vietnam memorabilia, pictures and videos, books, that sort of thing. So it was always around us, and we always knew what had happened to our father. We never knew him any other way, so we always knew what had happened to him.
He just couldn't take it anymore. He tried to drink the pain away. He tried to work it away. He tried to tell me and my brother everything that he went through. He tried talking about it. He tried everything. And when he first got there and everything, he was just out of high school, and what he encountered when he got over there was not what he expected at all. One of the missions that he had got sent on when he first got here was that they went into a village, and the whole time I've been here, I've been trying to ask people and everything, and the other day, we were at another VAVA office, and we were there with the general, and when he started to open the book, it was mentioned that my father was in Chu Lai. Everybody that was in there said, "Oh, Chu Lai." And it kind of made me start to think, well, what went on in Chu Lai that was so bad that everybody knows about it? And he was explaining all that. But then when he found Chu Lai on the map, he pointed at it and he cried and shut the book and pushed it away from him. And that really hit home, because that's where my dad was at. And then when we got to the museum and I found where his company and everything was at, and I saw it on the wall, and then I saw where they slaughtered all them women and children. And my dad was only 19 years old when he joined the military, when he came to Vietnam. So at 19 years old, that's what they told him to do. And they made him kill women and children. And there was like 500 of them. It wasn't like just one or two or three. It was 500 women and children. And like 70-something of those women were pregnant. So they killed the babies too. And that was the first week that my dad was here. And then he still had 13 more months to go after he had to do that. And he had to go through, I don't even know how many villages they dropped him off at, that they had to do the same thing, because that's when, during the war, it turned into basically a genocide, and everything that was out there, they killed it. Men, women, children, babies, dogs, cats, pigs, everything. They just went out there and they killed everything that they came in contact with. I got a ride from my dad and I went back to the state of California. It was Father's Day of 1997. I was coming home, and when I got to the house, I noticed there was a bunch of police cars outside of my house. And I thought maybe somebody had hurt somebody in my family, or maybe I was in trouble or something. I didn't know. So I hurried up and I pulled in the driveway and I asked them what was going on, and they said that they needed to talk to me. So I went and I went to the side with them and I started to talk to them, and they told me that there was some people that were riding some motorcycles, and They had found my dad's body out in the middle of the desert in his car, and that he had committed suicide. And it was so hard for me because all my life, my dad was always there. He always tried to help me. He helped take care of me. He helped make sure that I had my prosthetic legs and everything. And just all of a sudden, all at once, all of that was gone.
This war in Vietnam, guess what? It wasn't going like the other wars that the United States had been involved in. They think the idea that, you know, maybe America didn't win like they thought they were going to, or that there was subversive reasons for us getting into the conflict or the war itself, that America mismanaged their military, or they were after natural resources, or they just wanted land close to China. There is so much controversy just around those parameters.
The people actually got to see the war on TV. It was broadcast. They showed all the people that were getting blown up and all the kids that were getting sprayed and all the death and destruction of what the war was actually had going on in it. And once the American people saw how awful war really is, because most of the time in America, because nobody attacks America on their own soil or anything like that.
General, how would you assess yesterday's activities and today's? What is the enemy doing? Are these major attacks or...
This is the main Vietnamese language radio station in Saigon.
Snipers out. When the American people saw this, they started having riots in the street. They started protesting at the government. They started, like, just having all kinds of problems in the United States over it.
So many years after 1975 that it's still in infancy. Like, I don't think historians even know what to write about it. I don't think they know what's real. I don't think they know what's false about it, what's mythological about it, anything. I think at first it came out of the veteran's mouth, my kids are sick, I'm sick, and they said, guess what? You're just a bunch of baby killers. You're just a bunch of whiners. You're a bunch of drug addicts. Now you just want a free handout. That's what they were met with.
Agent Orange was a safe product when it was used in the Vietnam War, and it's a safe product today.
We don't mean to say that there isn't an Agent Orange effect, but at this point in time, we don't seem to see anything that confirms that there's something there specifically.
Just hours before, thousands of Vietnam veterans were supposed to be represented in court against seven chemical companies. There was an out-of-court settlement.
I think they just try to sweep it under the rug so nobody knows, so that people won't be trying to go, well, wait a minute, I have a bad liver, or wait a minute, I have a brother that's missing an arm and we've never had birth defects in our family, or wait a minute, now I know why you don't have any legs and all that. And then for all the people to come together and sue the chemical company, I think that's what their issue is. I think they don't want everybody to know about the Agent Orange, because if everybody knew how awful it was, and that the government, they would have to pay for medical bills and all kinds of stuff, and they don't want to do that, so they try to hide it and pretend like it never happened.
It's just still on the cusp. It's just out on the edge. Nobody will take it and pull it in. Very famous actor in the United States, Tom Hanks, currently doing The 60s. It's a documentary series that's been showing on CNN. I waited on bated breath, you know, he's talking about the 60s and the Vietnam War and showing film and how it affected. I was waiting, come on, nothing. I went to a speech with journalists who were here during the war, who weren't in the military but were journalists, very famous journalists in Pittsburgh a couple months ago. I waited. Come on, something. Say something. Sorry. It makes me so angry. They just erase our history. They erase it. It's gone. It doesn't exist. They don't care. And that has been what we've heard our entire lives. You're controversialist. You just want controversy. You're just making stuff up. No, it's happened. They talked about everything. They talked about the strife. They talked about this and that and what it was like to be here and how the troops were and what it was like in the... Say something. You come here as a journalist and you stayed in Vietnam. You were able to see both sides of the story. And you've been back to Vietnam. And you talk about it. Say something. You know that the children here are still suffering. You know that the Vietnam vets are suffering. Say something, nobody. You have people who are suffering, who have suffered their entire lives because of decisions people made in an office somewhere. They made the decision to spray this stuff. This is going to be a good idea. We're going to save people. People still today claim Agent Orange saved people. Okay, maybe it did. But those lives were worthwhile, and I don't diminish that at all. But there are millions of us that are suffering because of this chemical.
These people have taken me in. Like when we went to the Friendship Village and those Vietnamese veterans that came out, they were the NVA. They were the ones that were at war with my dad. And my dad probably shot at some of them, and some of them probably shot at my dad. And when I came face to face with those guys, that was a pretty intense moment because I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know if all of a sudden they were gonna have a flashback because they saw an American face, or I just had no idea what to expect. But after he sat there and looked at me in my eyes for a good minute, and he came over there and he gave me a big hug, and he told me that Vietnam doesn't want war. They don't want to hate the American people, that they just want to live in peace from now on. And
now that I've come and I've been able to put faces, it's been a wonderful experience to get the second side of the story. Every conflict, every problem has two sides. I'd been raised with one side of the story. Now I've gotten the second side of the story, and now I can take both those elements and put them together and formulate something to share with my children.
Just like my dad, I'm not going to lie about things when I get back to the United States and try to make it look nice or do anything. All my friends and family and stuff, I'm going to tell them how my trip was.
Once I came to Vietnam, I said, okay, this is more. This is more. This is bigger. This is bigger than Heather. Because a lot of my life was trying to deal with what happened to me. And when I came here and understood that the problem was way, way, way bigger than just me, or just a few of the kids that I had kind of connected with in the United States, I understood that I couldn't go back to just thinking of me and my story and my problems and those things. I knew I had to do more.
The Red Cross estimates that 3 million Vietnamese have been affected by dioxin, including at least 150,000 children born with serious birth defects. Millions of Americans and Vietnamese are still suffering directly and indirectly by the wartime U.S. spraying of Agent Orange and other herbicides over southern and central Vietnam. Question is, how many more generations must suffer, and how long will this deadly legacy of U.S. crimes against innocent lives linger on? Well, that's it, everyone, for this program. Until next time and another Aperture It's, goodbye.
Stories from the Ponds. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. I think it goes without dispute that one of the most important, essential, vital factors that can make any relationship, whether it's platonic, romantic, business, friendship, whatever, any family ties, even with strangers, any relationship work out properly is communication. Communication doesn't just mean the use of words. It means the ability to transfer information between two or more people. And this description often relies on several other factors in addition to words and verbs. Let's listen to a short little anecdote that I remember often when I'm at a loss for words or my voice rises a bit more than its usual resting place. It's an interesting one. Let's listen to it real quick and we'll be right back.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah the Almighty. Dear brothers and sisters, salam. So welcome to another episode of Lantern with a nice story. The title of today's story is Language of Love. A wise old man saw his grandson having a heated discussion with his wife. he asked his grandson, "Why do you raise your voice when you are arguing with your wife?" Grandson said, "I lose patience when she doesn't understand my point of view, and that is why I raise my voice." Grandfather said, "But your wife is close enough for her to hear you even when you say the same sentence in a calm manner. Why do you have to raise your voice?" His grandson said, "I raise my voice so that my voice is heard and I can also let out the steam by raising my voice." Grandfather said, "That is not the exact reason for you to raise your voice. The real reason is that when you're angry with your wife, your heart moves away from her heart. So even though you are physically close to each other, you feel that you are far away from one another and hence raise your voice." His grandson replied, "If that is the reason for raising the voice, what do we do when we are in love?" Grandfather said, "When two people are in love, their hearts are close to each other. Even if you whisper softly, you both can hear very clearly. At such time, one can communicate with the loved ones even through the language of silence." Yes, as William James says, whenever you're in conflict with someone, there is one factor that can make a difference between damaging your relationship and deepening it. That factor is attitude.
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
I don't really necessarily want to focus only on the volume of our speech, though that is the apparent moral of the story, but it could also be like a representation or symbolic to how the quality of the things we say are really, really important. Often we find we say something to someone and we didn't really mean anything by it, but the tone of our voice, the tone which we used in order to convey our message, didn't really sit well with them. And they would say in response, "It's not what you said, it's how you said it." And presentation is absolutely everything. In every field, in food, in media, in speech, in meeting with people, you know, the way they present themselves, that first impression that they make, means everything to us. And also, as the Ahadith tell us, the way we speak is a representation of our character, our choice of words, the tone of our voice, whether it's lenient or harsh or rough or soft and gentle and kind. The volume of our voice, whether we speak with a set, with a resting, somber, calm tone, or whether we yell and are constantly sound, absolutely exasperated. And all of that has an effect on the other person and often what they pick up from what we said. Sometimes something sounds a certain way in our head, but when the frequencies are released into the air and it reaches the other person's ear, they hear something entirely different. I know this has happened to me more than one occasion, and it's caused so much misunderstanding and so much hurt and so much upset, which were absolutely unintentional. Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam states many invaluable and deep, insightful ahadith regarding the quality which one's speech must possess. His Eminence often advised his followers, his companions, his soldiers, not to swear, not to use bad, profane words. Because again, that's a representation of who we are as a person, whether we are noble and polite and well-mannered, or we are vulgar and base and probably have anger management issues. He often, we hear this hadith often from him, that speaks before he thinks, and a wise person thinks before they speak, which means we have to really meticulously analyze the things that we choose to say, because number one, we never know how other people are going to hear it. Number two, if it's not beneficial, if it's not going to help make any situation better, if it's not going to help make someone feel better, then there is really no point in saying it at all. In fact, our scholars and our mystics and even our Islamic leaders have all emphasized on the fact that one of the tools which can aid us on the path of wayfaring and mysticism is to lessen our speech. And our ahadith tell us that that is the sign of piety, or a person who's more focused on the remembrance of Allah, one of the signs is that they will speak less. Or another hadith that tells us when the mind, the intellect becomes complete, the words lessen. So basically, the point here is that we really, really need to be super aware, super mindful, super careful and vigilant about the way we speak, what we say, and who we say it to. We can try that. Try it for a day, try it for a week, and see the difference it makes, it creates in your peace of mind and in your relationship with others. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a very important question that gets asked a lot by Muslims, especially by Muslims living in non-Muslim countries or Muslims, you know, who are living in countries where there is a large concentration of non-Muslims. It could often be asked by people who are Muslim, but they have non-Muslim relatives, such as converts. The question is this: is it permissible for a Muslim to pray for a non-Muslim or not? This is a question that gets asked a lot of times, and we'd like to answer it today. According to a lot of the verses of the Holy Quran, apparently, it seems that these verses want to say that no, this is not permissible. For example, in one of the verses of the Holy Quran, we read the following. The Quran says that it's not permissible for the Prophet, مَا كَانَ لِلنَّبِيِّ وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا, or those who believe, to ask forgiveness for the polytheists, وَلَوْ كَانُوا أُولُو قُرْبَى, even if they are their relatives. So this verse apparently seems to say that, you know, this is not permissible. And if it's not permissible to ask forgiveness for your non-Muslim relatives, obviously you can't ask forgiveness for your non-Muslim neighbors or other people who have a less right over you than these relatives. Right. So this verse seems to say that this is something which is impermissible and we're not allowed to do it. But if we continue reading this verse of the Holy Quran, we will understand that there's a condition and a clause for this impermissibility, and that's that this is up to the point where we are sure that these people, there's no chance for the guidance of these people, there's no chance that these people could be guided or forgiven by God, and that they're definitely going to hell. Because in continuation, God says, after it becomes sure for them, meaning the believers, that they, in other words, these polytheists, are the inhabitants of hell. Right? So the converse of this, obviously, is that if we're not sure about it, why not? We can ask forgiveness for them. There's no problem in it. The most glaring instance and case of this is after this person dies. Obviously, after a human being dies, the doors of repentance are closed to a person, right? The doors of repentance are open for a person up to death, the time of death. After that, you know, forgiveness is not accepted by God. So after a person dies, after a non-Muslim dies, we can't say that, oh God, please forgive this person. Please forgive my relative who died and was a non-Muslim. Forgive him. Don't send him to hell. This would be impermissible for us. But up to that point, yeah, why not? We can ask forgiveness for them and ask God to guide them to the straight path. Now, this is specifically, and a very important point here we want to make is that this is specifically, the topic we're talking about is specifically asking forgiveness for the non-Muslim, right? Istighfar, asking forgiveness from this, which comes from the verse that we were talking about. But the verse doesn't say anything else about other types of prayers, praying for them in other ways, for other reasons. In fact, right, we have a prayer in the famous book of prayers, the Sahifa Sajjadiyyah, in which the Imam asks and prays for non-Muslims, right? Not forgiveness, asking forgiveness for them, but ask God, you know, for other things, you know, with respect to everybody. It's a general prayer. For example, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam says, Allahumma aghni kulla faqir. Oh God, you know, make every poor person self-sufficient. It doesn't say make every poor Muslim self-sufficient. Or he says, Allahumma ashbi' kulla ja'i. Please feed, oh Allah, please feed every hungry person. It doesn't say hungry non-Muslim or hungry Muslim. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the permissibility of praying for non-Muslims. in the verses of the Holy Quran and the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.